I'd also like to acknowledge my advisory committee, Drs. Matt Gray, Craig Harper, and Lisa Muller from here at East, and Dr. Richard Kaminsky from Mississippi State University. North American waterfowl populations declined in the 1980s. Hypothesized mechanisms for this included long-term drought, pollution, urbanization, and the degradation and destruction of wetlands. In response to declining waterfowl numbers, the North American Waterfowl Management Plan was created in 1986. It's implemented joint ventures that act regionally, such as the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture, and non-breeding areas such as the Southeast. The focus of joint ventures is typically on providing good quality foraging habitat so that we build reserves lost in southward migration and ultimately return north in good condition to breed. This is a diagram showing North American migration flyways. In Tennessee, we get a few birds headed east toward the Atlantic Flyway, and annually we see millions of birds headed south down the Mississippi Flyway, with the majority of those coming through West Tennessee. And that's because West Tennessee lies in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, shown in pink on the graph there, or on the map there. The Mississippi Alluvial Valley was historically a vast hardwood bottomland with a few interspersed early successional wetlands. So food resources for waterfowl in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley traditionally included acorns and moist soil plants, but today more than 75% of the Mississippi Alluvial Valley has been drained and much of it converted to agriculture. So food resources have changed accordingly from acorns and moist soil seeds to agricultural commodities. And these seeds are very between 58 and 97% of the wintering diets of American green-winged teal and mallards are comprised of seeds, and much of that today is waste grain, or grain that's left in the field following harvest, as evidenced by the American green-winged teal there with corn coming out of his esophagus. The standard for quantifying waterfowl food foraging availability and carrying capacity is through duck energy days, which you may have also heard referred to as duck use days. Duck energy days are simply the number of birds that can be energetically sustained in an area for a given amount of time, and they're calculated by multiplying the amount of available food by the true metabolizable energy of that food and dividing that by the daily energy of a bird. So how does the agricultural landscape of today compare with the more natural hardwood bottomland landscape that once covered the Mississippi Alluvial Valley? These are some numbers that are currently being used by the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture to guide their management decisions. With respect to true metabolizable energy, corn and grain sorghum, you can see, are much higher than either soybeans, acorns, or moist soil seeds. But when we look at the number of duck energy days provided per hectare, moist soil areas provide four times or more what the other foraging habitats are providing. But recall that the majority of the Mississippi Alluvial Valley was once covered in hardwood bottomlands primarily, so mass-producing, acorn-producing areas. And these provide between 270 and 1,100 duck energy days per hectare, which is about the same or less than the numbers that the Lower Mississippi Venture are using for corn and grain sorghum currently. But these estimates for corn, grain sorghum, and soybean are probably inaccurate. And that's due to changes in harvest efficiency and timing. The studies that they're using are outdated from the 1980s or earlier, and agriculture production has changed in the last 20 or 30 years. And the studies are also from geographic areas such as Nebraska, Iowa, and Texas that differ greatly from the southeastern U.S. in terms of climate. So it's a lot hotter and more humid here. It's vitally important that we have good numbers to calculate the number of duck energy days on a landscape, because in accordance with the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, there's a major effort each year to calculate the number of duck energy days, say, in Tennessee, and also to meet goals with respect to the number of duck energy days that we're providing. So you can imagine that it's, you know, difficult or impossible to make good management decisions using inaccurate numbers. So the objectives of my were to estimate the biomass of agricultural seeds in harvested and unharvested corn, grain sorghum, and soybean fields from harvest through January, and January is when peak numbers of waterfowl arrive in Tennessee, quantify the amount, rate, and fate of grain loss in agricultural fields from harvest to January, to compare our January biomass estimates with those that are used currently by the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture, so those numbers that I presented in the table, to compare grain biomass and fates among four climate zones in Tennessee, to compare the biomass of waste grain among land ownership categories, state and private, and finally, to relate microclimate conditions to rates of grain decomposition and grain. And today I'm going to present preliminary results on the perspectives. Study plots were located throughout the state on federal, state, and private land. Sites on federal land were located in the Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge Duck River Unit, located near the town of New Johnsonville, Tennessee. On the Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge, we had four corn and four soybean fields that were each harvested in a strip-split plot design, such that each field had four plots, two harvested and two unharvested, for a total of eight harvested, eight unharvested plots per grain species. And here's a photograph of what that looks like on the ground, showing the two unharvested and the two harvested plots. And again, an aerial photo showing the unharvested and harvested plots. We also had four grain sorghum fields on the Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge, but none of this was harvested because the farmer wasn't interested in selling the grain. Study sites on state and private land throughout the four climate regions in Tennessee. Corn and soybean production occurs statewide, so we were able to establish plots at four fields each per region for a total of 16 fields each for corn and soybean. Grain sorghum production, however, is limited to West Tennessee, even more restricted to this region, and total sites equaled five fields. And the locations of the fields are shown in orange on the map there. Okay, methods. Okay, recall the graph of the experimental units set up on the Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge. This is just a diagrammatic representation of that. Experimental units were 0.202 hectares with a grid overlain for the random generation of subsampling locations. Our subsampling were based on corn sampling theory developed by Frederick et al. In 1984, and it's kind of this nested design. So we had this large 4.57 by 8.84 meter rectangle in which we would gather all the seed aggregates that we could find, so corn cobs or grain sorghum seed heads. And nested within that was a smaller 0.3 meter by 4.57 meter rectangle in which we'd gather individual seeds or kernels. Now for corn and grain sorghum, they each have that are aggregated heads, you know, corn has a lot of seeds on it. So if we only sample a smaller area, kind of the random, you know, if there was a corn cob there or not, just based on where the plot was placed, would really make our estimates highly variable. So we sampled the larger plot and the smaller nested plot for both corn and grain sorghum. Soybeans, on the other hand, only have three or four seeds per pod, so the random inclusion or exclusion of an individual soybean pod wouldn't affect our results very much. We only sampled the small plot for harvested soybean fields, and also for all of our unharvested crops, because there you're dealing with a situation where you've got all or almost entirely aggregate, so the random inclusion or exclusion of a single aggregate wouldn't affect the results that much again. Okay, part C on the diagram shows the location and design of our microclimate or fate plots. I'll be talking about that a little bit more here in a minute. All of these fields were sampled every 2 weeks post-harvest or post-drydown for unharvested crops. And at each sampling period, three subsampling plots were randomly selected. And here's a photograph of us searching for corn cobs. All cobs that had more than 10 kernels on them or sorghum seed heads more than 5 centimeters in length were collected out of that large rectangle. And that looks like it's got more than 10 seeds on it, so this is an aggregate. Here's a photographic soybean subsampling plot. And that's what it looks like after we finish with it. Samples were first threshed and all non-seed parts removed, stored in a freezer, dried to constant mass in a desiccating oven, and finally weighed to get the biomass estimates. Okay, second major method was quantifying seed fate. So there's basically four things that can happen to a seed that lies in the field. It can decompose, it can germinate, it can be depredated, which is a fancy way of saying eaten by granivore, or it can remain intact. So as I mentioned earlier, this microclimate subplot was located in the center of each experimental unit, and it consisted of an open and an exposed plot set 5 meters apart from each other. And here's a photograph of what that looks like in showing the exposed and the open plot. To set these things up, we scattered 100 seeds under this wire mesh granivore exposure and 100 seeds in the open plot, 5 meters from it. And every time from harvest through January, we counted the numbers of intact, germinated, and decomposed seeds. We never added any seeds to either plot during the study period, but we did remove germinated, decomposed seeds to ensure that we didn't count them twice in the next period if they were still there. Seed recovery under the exposure and in the open plot gives us an idea of how many seeds were depredated. Here's another photo of the experimental setup. To set these plots up, we first removed all the chaff in the pre-existing seed, then rescattered the seed and rescattered 100 seeds and rescattered the chaff to emulate field conditions. And an up-close look at the granivore exposure. Each site had a hobo weather logger housed in that big white radiation shield. The weather logger measured temperature and relative humidity, and we'll use this data to quantify the influence of microclimate on seed loss and fate. Okay, preliminary results. We did means and standard errors for our January biomass estimates and qualitatively compared these to estimates that are currently being used by the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture. We looked at temporal declines in the biomass of seed using repeated measures ANOVA and Tukey's multiple comparison tests. These analyses were run in SAS at an alpha level of 0.05. We'll be presenting the overall percent loss each fate in those microclimate fate plots. So our January estimates for harvested seed. We found that corn offered around 200 duck energy days per hectare. Grain sorghum offered zero. Soybean fields averaged around 20 duck energy days per hectare. Now there's this giving up density at 50 kilograms per hectare at which it's no longer profitable for waterfowl to forage in a field. And hence, duck energy days are functionally zero when biomass of seed declines below. So on the landscape of the fields that we sampled, 92% of corn and soybean fields were below this giving up density in January, and 100% of grain sorghum fields were below this density. So when we compare these numbers to those that are being used currently by the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture, we find that our estimates for corn biomass and duck energy days are 84% lower. Our estimate of zero duck energy days for grain sorghum is considerably less than the nearly 1,200 that the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture is currently using. And our estimate of around 20 duck energy days per hectare is 78% lower than their estimate of around 90 duck energy days per hectare. So those are some pretty significant differences there. Okay, looking at temporal declines in biomass, along the y-axis is biomass in kilograms per hectare. Along the x-axis is months post-harvest, starting at zero, so immediately post-harvest. Different letters above the error bars represent statistical differences based on the Tukey's test. And the red dashed line is that giving up density at 50 kilograms per hectare. So you can see that corn initially had around 300 kilograms per hectare. That declined to almost nothing by 4 months post-harvest. Between 2 and 3 months post-harvest, corn biomass dropped below the 50 kilogram per hectare, giving up density. Similar trend with respect to soybeans, nearly 120 kilograms per hectare immediately post-harvest, declining to less than 20 kilograms per hectare by 3 months post-harvest. And soybeans dropped below the giving up density within 1 month after harvest. Okay, again, similar trend with grain sorghum, although it wasn't statistically significant. Nearly, or over 500 kilograms per hectare initially post-harvest, dropping to almost 3 months post-harvest. And grain sorghum declined below the giving up density by 2 months post-harvest. Okay, so what happened? 68% of our corn seeds in those fate plots were depredated, 16% decomposed, 10% germinated, and only 6% remained intact by January. 35% of soybeans decomposed, 40% germinated, 7% were depredated, and 18% remained intact in January. Of grain sorghum seeds decomposed 61%, 22% germinated, 17% were depredated, and no grain sorghum seeds remain intact in January. It's important to note that the data that I presented on seed fate represents individual seeds scattered on the ground. We observed that seed that seemed to decline a little bit more slowly than individual seeds, as evidenced by the photograph of the corn cob there. You can see all the seeds that were in contact with the ground had germinated, but the seeds on the top are still intact and doing fine, so declining a little bit more slowly. That can happen for aggregates that are just lying on the ground or those that are on standing plants that were missed entirely by the combine. Actually, this year we did these microclimate fate plots so that we can quantify rates of decline for seed aggregates. Okay, just to sum this up, we had around 194 duck energy days per hectare in the corn fields, but 92% of those fields on a landscape had no duck energy days. So this implies that there's a few fields out there with a lot of corn left in them in January, but the majority of the fields are offering nothing in terms of forage quality to ducks. The majority of corn loss between harvest and January was due to depredation. Similar trend with soybeans, 92% had zero duck energy days in January, average 20 duck energy days, most were germination. And 100% of grain sorghum fields sampled had zero duck energy days per hectare in January. Losses were attributed primarily to decomposition. So we're able to make some preliminary management recommendations based upon this data. First is to delay harvest if possible, especially given that fields may have no value to waterfowl. It would be necessary to plant additional food plots and delay bush hogging of spring crops until just before the birth. And perhaps the best option to increase waterfowl carrying capacity through the management of natural wetlands, such as moist soil impoundments, because the decomposition of moist soil seeds is much slower compared with agricultural seeds. And I'd like to thank UT's Department of Forestry, Wildlife, and Fisheries, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency for providing funds, and a whole host of individuals who helped with locating field sites, housing, help in the field. And I'll take some questions if there's time.
Yeah, I have a question. It seems like it depends on that giving up factor.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Pat Cobb, if you'd like to just cite to some of that, and it's fairly lower, you know?
Absolutely. So the question was, I guess, the giving up density is going to depend, I guess, not just on a density, but on the availability, not just abundance, but availability of seed. So if you have seed that's clustered, you know, the ducks may come in for it. That's absolutely true. For example, burning off the chaff will increase its use by ducks because the food is so much more easy to find. So, yeah, it's just an in general on a landscape scale.
Maybe that 50 kilos is the worst case, and they might be able to feed effectively below that, given you burned it or if it was.
Oh, I would say, I think based on Rutka's thesis, it's an average case.
Average.
You know, you may have more than 50 kilograms per hectare. You know, you may have 200 kilograms per hectare, but you know, tons of chaff. It's you know, difficult to find, or maybe you have 200 kilograms per hectare that somebody came through and disked. You know, it's not available to the waterfowl. So I would say 50 is an average case. So the question is, are the values that the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture are currently using, are they inflated or are our estimates low? I think if you recall the graphs I showed for temporal decline, the estimates that they're using are, Nebraska, Iowa, you know, the refrigerator region of the world. I think that here in Tennessee, we're seeing rapid decline in the amount of seed. So if it were much colder here, you know, and there wasn't as much decomposition, germination, I think we would see numbers that were more comparable to those that they estimate for Nebraska.
I was also wondering about soils, you know, on the Delta side of Mississippi, on the river, and Louisiana, and the soils are a lot better.
Question is, can the amount of, or the quality of the soil affect food availability? I have a really good answer to that. My gut thing is that I don't think that soil quality would affect it anymore. I guess, you know, if you have a high-yielding crop, perhaps you're leaving more on the ground. You know, average is, say, 5% or less of the standing crop that's left. But as far as rates of decomposition or germination, I don't think soil quality has a whole lot to do with rates of decline after harvest.
We'll have to wrap up for the time for the next presentation. Give Melissa a round of applause.